Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I am well. Hope you are too, Melissa, and your listeners.
I appreciate that. So today is Black Women Equal Pay Day, and it's obviously addressing the wage gap that we're seeing for Black women. But beyond that, Senator, I wanted to know from a lawmaker's perspective, what's being done right now to bridge the wage gap that we're not only seeing with minorities, but also even just between men and women? That's still a huge problem.
Great question, Melissa. And the fact is that women still earn less than men for the same work. The figure until recently has been about 70 cents on the dollar. It may be slightly better now, but it's still way below what it should be, way below equality and equity. And so we are pushing additional legislation, hard to do in the Senate because our Republican colleagues, and they're in the majority, have been against it. But we're going to continue fighting for equal pay for equal work. And that's a very important principle. You know, the Ledbetter Law achieved it in part, but now it has to be broadened. And it also has to be enforced more rigorously because a lot of the enforcement depends on women themselves bringing lawsuits, which can be costly, time-consuming, and emotionally difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. And forgive me for being naive, but to me, it does seem like we've made, like you said, strides. We have made progress, but does it have to be this complicated? I mean, could it be more simplified, if you will, to monitor or have something in place that, look, if you have somebody who is working, doing the exact same job, but maybe unless they're doing a substantially better job than the other person and deserve to make more, shouldn't there just be something in work contracts or employers have to, like, be held to a higher standard that, you know, if this guy's making $10 an hour, she should be making $10 an hour. Does it have to be so complicated, or have we just made it to the point where this is just sort of a standard that's been around for generations that we need to get more in depth with it?
It should be pretty simple, but there are a lot of barriers to the law working in practice. For example, a lot of women have no access to the information to know whether they're being paid the same. The law requires that they be paid the same for the same work. And in some circumstances, they can gain access to that information. But you can be working in a job as a woman without there being any public information about the pay to men surrounding you. And you have no way of knowing unless you ask, but then you may not be told the truth, or you may not be told anything.
Mm-hmm.
So information itself is difficult to get. And then, you know, a lot of women, I think, just do the job and maybe they assume that they're being paid equitably. But I think there still is a lot of kind of implicit disapproval, even condemnation, to asking the question in the workplace.
Mm.
And I think we need to change the culture as well as the law.
So maybe it's something that has to do with training for employers, but even for employees and educating women better on knowing that maybe you're being taken advantage of, or maybe you should know what the average amount should be. You know, maybe that's a matter of having more trainings in place so that both sides of this would be more educated in this matter. No?
I think training could be very, very important. Training provided both by the employer and by others outside
mm-hmm.
the place of employment. And I will just add as a footnote that this topic has been very much of interest to Kamala Harris, the newly chosen Democratic vice presidential candidate. I know because I've worked with her on it. Equal pay for equal work has been certainly a topic very much on her mind as a Black woman. And I think it will be important to her in the campaign and also as vice president if she is elected.
talking this morning with Senator Richard Blumenthal. And before I let you go, Senator, the CIAC has decided to go forward with high school fall sports, and that includes football here in Connecticut. Now, I know I've heard from you here on the show about college, even professional teams, and wanting them to hold back this season because of COVID. What are your thoughts on the CIAC's decision, and would you urge parents to think twice about allowing their kids to play next month?
Parents really have to assess the risks, Melissa, and as a former high school parent, I'm still very much a parent with four children, but my kids are well beyond high school. You know, I would never presume to tell another parent what to do. Mm-hmm. These risks have to be assessed individually. And my only really advice would be listen to the scientists and the doctors and the medical experts, not the politicians. I'm certainly no medical expert, but the risks are very significant. There are ways to mitigate them, and I think that high school officials and coaches, athletic directors will try to mitigate them. But look at what's happening at the college level. More conferences are deciding against going forward with football. And just another footnote here, later today, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey and I are going to be announcing an athlete bill of rights for college athletes, which gives them a platform, a set of rights to empower them to have greater control over how they are treated, whether their name, image, and likeness is rewarded financially, and whether their rights to health care and scholarships are protected. So I think we need to respect college athletes. The same goes for high school athletes. They have lives beyond the playing field, and I hope we're not risking their health or lives in any way because they deserve the best.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you so much for stopping by this morning, and I will talk to you again after I get back from vacation in a couple weeks. Thank you so much.
Have a great vacation, Melissa. You work so hard, you certainly deserve it.
Oh, gosh, you're so sweet. I appreciate you. Thank you. Tanya Hughes is here with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Tanya, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Tanya. So actually, we didn't talk about this yesterday, but I realized this morning in my news headline something incredibly important going on today, and that's Black Women Equal Pay Day. First of all, would love to get your perspective on this. How much have we progressed as a nation, but where do we need to still go?
Well, women are still undervalued in our community, which is why you see such a big pay gap. Equal Pay Day refers to the gender pay gap for women in general, but for Black women, it's a much wider gap. Mm. For women in general, you usually have about a 19 or 18% gap behind what men are paid in similar situations. But for African American women, it's more like 39%. So when the economy hits, it hits, you know, those communities much harder.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And earlier in the show, we talked to Senator Richard Blumenthal. He had actually made note that Kamala Harris is big into bridging that gap and making it a lot closer, if not completely equal, which it should be at this point. I'm surprised that we still struggle with this in 2020. But I thought it was a nice segue to talking about her a little bit. First of all, talk to us a little bit about the weight of the history here, because I think whether or not you are a Republican, you're a Democrat, you are for or against Kamala Harris, I think that this decision is historic for America. Talk to us a little bit about that.
It's absolutely historic. And as Joe Biden said, her story truly is an American story as someone who helped integrate the school systems in California. Regardless of what your ideology is, we must respect the magnitude of this moment. She's a Black woman who is of Jamaican and Asian descent. She's a member of a historically Black sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated. I'm a member as well. It was the first African-American sorority founded in 1908 on Howard University's campus, a school that she attended, and she pledged the sorority there. That alone affirms the tremendous diversity that exists within our communities and shows that, you know, she has a wide span of support just based on those types of affiliations. I think we've already seen a tremendous support in funding since the announcement. I saw that she was able to raise over $26 million in 24 hours just based on that announcement. So wow. It's an incredibly important time in our country's history. I am completely excited, and my timeline is just flooded with excitement about this announcement.
And Tanya, just to kind of remind some of our listeners, the way that you and I connected and the Commission on Human Rights was back when we decided to do what I kind of called on social media our blackout broadcast, which was that we focused on Black-owned restaurants and Black entrepreneurs and different groups and being able to highlight our Black community. And I think what connected us was the first time I talked on the phone with you. One of the things that is still very difficult, I would say, for our society is being able to ask questions, but not feeling like we're offensive or feeling like we're out of turn, but learning and really having the opportunity to learn. And what I appreciated about you was you are very non-judgmental. You want to teach, and I felt very comfortable asking you questions. And yesterday was one of those moments where, since having you on the show, I was flooded, actually. My inbox was flooded with questions about me referring to Kamala Harris as an African American. And I didn't even know how to really word the question to you. I just knew if I asked it, I would get, you know, some kind of insight. And a lot of our listeners said, like you had mentioned, her father was Jamaican, her mother was Indian. So how can she refer to herself as an African American? So do you mind answering that question for our listeners?
Certainly. I mean, it is a very nuanced term, as I mentioned to you yesterday. It has a lot of historical basis because how Blacks have been described in America has changed throughout history. Even within my own immediate family, I can look at the birth certificates of my mom and dad. My mom's birth certificate describes her as a Negro. My dad, who was born in South Carolina, describes him as colored. My birth certificate states that I am Black, and my children's birth certificate state African American. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of synonymous terms that have evolved throughout the history because of the nation evolving and being more sensitive and culturally aware of how we want to be perceived and how we are perceived in the nation. But basically, African American is a term that kind of combines all of that and refers to Black Americans who are of African American descent, regardless of what that combination is. If you are an American and you are Black and brown, for the most part, we accept you as African American. It doesn't matter if you're 10% Jamaican, 10% Hispanic. You know, if you're brown and you qualify yourself as African American, you're accepted as African American. And I appreciate you bringing these types of questions to the forefront, and I'm always willing to talk and explore them further because, as Ida B. Wells said, the way to fight wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them.
Yeah, and forgive me. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Tanya, and I appreciate that explanation. And forgive me if I'm wrong. Please correct me, actually, is the better term of saying it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, when you look back, if you really, really want to go back in the history books, it's not like Jamaicans just kind of popped up. I mean, they do come from an African descent, correct?
They're of African descent. They
right.
are all of African descent. So African American kind of embraces the entire African diaspora.
Okay. So it is accurate to say she is the first African American woman.
She is the first African American woman to be nominated as a vice presidential candidate by any major party.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, I appreciate that clarification. I know our listeners do too, because like I said, we're all learning. We're all trying to sort of navigate through and I think be better people. And
yes.
I appreciate that.
So thank you for the question, Melissa.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tanya, again, I will be checking back in with you when I get back from vacation in a week. So thank you so much. And I will talk to you in a little bit.
Enjoy that vacation.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Checking in right now with Dr. Fred Brown of Griffin Health. And Dr. Brown, thanks for being here. How you doing?
Very good. How are you, Melissa?
Doing fine, thank you. So a lot of people talking about the buzz out of Russia and the news about a vaccine there. What are you thinking? Reliable? What were your thoughts on this?
You know, it's always tough to say. I think it's very encouraging. It's definitely not surprising. We should be around this time expecting to see a vaccine. I'm not familiar with sort of the efficacy or what version they're actually using. But again, I know throughout the world, we've been working on a vaccine. So very encouraging.
I know a lot of people get nervous when you hear about people in different phases and people almost competing to be like the first to have the vaccine. But it is a good thing that we've got so many different groups of people working on this, right?
Right. Absolutely. And we want to make sure, we want to make sure that it's safe. We don't want to make sure. And we do know that there's been some unethical practices on different aspects of this. So we want to be really careful that what is, what has been defined as the vaccine is actually gone through the appropriate trials. They're safe and effective.
And Dr. Fred Brown, I have seen, actually, surprisingly this week, a lot of studies, and I wanted to talk about each of them with you, if you don't mind, all COVID-related. Let's start with this one, because I actually just ordered one, so that when I run in and out of stores, it's a little bit easier than grabbing the mask and remembering it, and that's a neck gaiter. So I know in amusement parks and things like that, you are not allowed to wear a neck gaiter, because it's sort of ineffective and it could still spread your germs. But I thought it was okay to be able to wear these, like I said, if you have to run in really quick to go pick up something from the store, or, just so that people have that peace of mind, if you will. But studies are showing that neck gaiters are actually worse than if you just don't wear a mask at all. What's the truth behind this?
That is actually interesting. I saw that study also, and that was out of Duke. So that was pretty reputable study. What they did is, and again, it depends what you're doing for studies. So what they did is they actually were able to detect particles that pass through a barrier, and they were able to measure those particles. And what they found, and not to go into the full details, but what they found is certain types of cloth coverings would actually not only not stop the droplets, but actually split them and make them a little bit more aerosolized. Now, again, this is not the virus. This is actually a study that demonstrates sort of how effective something is to not aerosolize. So they then inferred that if you actually wear things like a neck gaiter or a handkerchief, because they are thin, what happens is they can potentially break up the particles and maybe even aerosolize it a little bit more. Again, you got to take that sort of with, the inference that's actually there, where they found that regular surgical masks and cloth masks, so just regular cotton cloth masks, didn't do that. They actually captured the particles and didn't transmit them.
Okay, so probably in layman's terms, a good idea to just invest in the masks and leave the gaiters behind.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, that's what I needed to know. So don't wear the gaiter out. Just wear it as a headband. I got
it. Wear it as a headband. Yeah, and if anything, it's probably more effective to have a modified T-shirt than it is to have a bandana.
Wow. Okay, yeah, that's a big difference. Because remember in the beginning of the pandemic, it was like, just cover yourself, whatever that means. And now, we're 5 months into it. So now the standards have to be a little bit better. So that is very helpful. Thank you.
And it's an early study. So as I said, and there's a lot of these studies that sort of come out. So, again, that's how I would interpret that one.
Now, I'm sure you saw this one. There's a study saying that when you're indoors, you actually could spread germs as far as 16 feet apart, not 6 feet apart, which is a huge difference. Now, how accurate is that?
That one is really dependent on where you are, what's happening, what's kind of ventilation you have within the organization that you're in. So there's a lot of nuances associated with that. And again, I think it just goes to the fact that it's important to wear, to wear a mask. We do know that you're probably a little bit safer outside than you are inside. You have two factors with that. One, you have the aspect of, you know, potentially wearing a mask. The other is, you know, there is a little bit of wind, but also sunlight and UV light kills viruses, kills all viruses.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I would probably take that along the lines of, you know, it is possible, and it's possible to develop designs if there's no airflow whatsoever or a forced airflow. Yeah, I mean, the germs could spread a little bit longer, but I would not take much into that.
Okay. And my last study that I saw, which to me is sort of a no-brainer, and I just love that they keep coming out with more reasons not to vape, because I don't know why we're still discussing it. Right. Just don't do it. But there was something else that came out that said teens and young adults who vape are actually 5 to 7 times more likely to catch COVID-19. Now, I would imagine that's because this could impact your lungs and sort of your respiratory system, which is right in line with COVID symptoms, right?
Absolutely. You know, and again, I think anything that causes damage to your lungs, vaping, smoking, it causes a significant reaction in your lungs and decreases your local immune system. So your first defense against a virus or a bacteria is actually eliminated when you smoke or vape. So it stunts those little cilia that get rid of all this kind of debris that you have in your lungs. So absolutely, I would not be surprised at that. And if you remember before COVID, we were seeing a lot of people who were getting very sick from vaping. There was deaths associated with vaping. It's, you know, the water that's potentially brought in, is it clean? What's potentially coming in? How is it irritating the lungs? But yeah, there's several episodes of severe lung disease secondary to vaping.
Dr. Fred Brown of Griffin Health. I think I'm going to start calling this segment the, I don't want to call it the debunk the studies, but it's like deeper dive into the studies with Dr. Fred Brown. What do you think?
Sounds good.
I feel
Absolutely.
Like that's becoming our weekly segment now, and
Absolutely.
I love it.
Happy to get, there's a lot of misinformation that's out there between the lay press and, you know, there's an interpretation of studies where it comes from very good organizations, but their nuances, and you know, sometimes there are people who want to get their sort of 15 minutes of fame to, mm-hmm. to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
So anything I can do to help.
Well, we appreciate it. We're glad we have Dr. Fred Brown in our back pocket. None of that other stuff. We've got Dr. Fred Brown. So there you go.
Well, thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again really soon. Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau is here now to talk about what else but a scam. Hello, Luke. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm telling you, I hate that you've become this way, Luke, because, you know, you are my friend outside of this job, but you have become my scam man, you know, like you tell me about the latest scams that happen and I appreciate it. But I mean, you must get tired of talking about the scams all the time.
I don't. I kind of see it in a positive light of I'm able to tell people about them. So hopefully you don't fall for them.
See,
so.
Do you all know why I love him so much? See this? He loves this because this is why you do what you do. So, Luke, I'm seeing your headline here. New data showing 80% of the money that we're losing to sweepstakes, lotteries and prize schemes are people over the age of 65. And that is a lot of our listeners. Let's talk about this.
Yeah, so there's a lot of lottery prize scams out there. We see them all year long. And right now is a time where a lot of people need that extra cash. So we do not want someone falling for any type of lottery or prize scam, especially during this COVID era we are kind of in. Unfortunately, in a prize scam or a lottery scam, we do see people in the age group of 65 or older losing the highest amounts of cash in these scams. So how does a lottery or prize scam happen? So usually you are either contacted by mail, phone call, email, and you're told that you won a huge prize. I would say about half the time, it's a person saying that you won a lottery outside of our country. And I just want to tell you now that it is illegal to play international lotteries. So if you are a U.S. citizen, you cannot play other lotteries in other countries.
Okay.
So if you get a call like that, it is a scam. So you cannot win any international prize or lottery from some other country here in the U.S. So automatically, you should know that that is a scam. Also, these scammers are extremely convincing, and they convince you that you either have to pay taxes or you have to pay a fee up front in order to get your prize. So again, one of our top tips is you should never have to pay in order to win a true lottery. So if you do hit a jackpot and you check your ticket, it's not like you owe money to win money, if that makes sense.
It does. The thing, and forgive me, so I don't do a lot of sweepstakes or things like this, but do you get a lot of these options in the mail? Like, to me, and again, I'm sure you're going to make fun of me, but I always thought this was something that you had to, like, go to a gas station or something to go and get, you know, into lotteries and things like that.
Sure, yeah. So it's actually kind of two categories, I would say. So
okay.
A sweepstakes is usually something you would enter via mail or online, possibly, almost
okay.
like a publisher's clearinghouse type of sweepstakes or a trip or any of those things. Lotteries, yes. Usually have to go in and buy a ticket, buy a scratcher, buy a Powerball ticket, any of those at some location. You also brought up, though, a great tip is you can't win a prize if you didn't play the game. So you do have to pay to play most of the time, or you have to even enter. So if it's a prize you're approached with and you don't remember even entering for it, again, you have to enter in order to win any sort of prize. So if a person calls you and says, hey, you've hit England's lottery, it's $200 million, all you have to do is pay us $2,000 or $20,000, and then we will send you a check.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I didn't enter into the English lottery, so how can you win a prize you
right.
haven't entered for?
Right. But I think even, you know what, I noticed this the other day, Luke, and actually I'm glad you brought this up. Even if it's not international, the other day I got a text message actually from a store that I know I did not enter any sort of sweepstakes or anything. I think it was, and I don't mean to name drop, it was like a fabric uh-huh. store that I know I go
okay.
there and I buy stuff to yeah. make masks, but I got a text message from them, and it turns out, like, I called the store directly and I said, did I enter a sweepstakes? And they said, no, we've been hacked. But if I had clicked you know, so it doesn't even have to be international. I would imagine that sometimes people can also get fooled just by stuff in our own backyard. But if you did not enter something specifically, that's a good point. Then you can't really win something that you never even entered.
Exactly. And it's great that you picked up on that, too, and said, hey, I didn't enter to this, so how can I win something I didn't even know I entered? And it's good you called and asked them, too. I mean, it's kind of coming at us from all angles right now. It could mm-hmm. be a text message, just like you said. It could be in the mail. It could be a phone call. So you just constantly have to be on the lookout. And with these sort of lottery scams, I always talk about emotion too. So a lot of scammers prey on emotion. And let me tell you, if a person called me and said I won $200 million, your emotions instantly spike.
Oh, immediately.
And you are
sure.
extremely excited.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh my gosh, I just won $200 million. So really, you just have to take a breath. And again, if you think about you can't win international lotteries, if you didn't enter, how did you win? And you should not have to pay for a true prize.
Okay. No, makes a lot of sense. Luke, what is your website if people want to do the scam tracker or anything like that?
Yep. Anybody can go to bbb.org. Or if you would like to check out our scam tracker and see if any of these scams have actually happened in your town, you can check bbb.org/scam tracker.
All right. Simple enough. Luke Fry of the Better Business Bureau, thank you so much for coming on this morning, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Melissa.